Thank you very much, Tessa. Our next speaker is Bob Nyman, no stranger to these reviews. His talk today will be Environmental Flows for Rivers, Theory, Progress, and Applications. Bob?
Okay, thanks, Pete. Pete, hold on just a minute. Can you pass those out when the time comes, or at least start to circulate them?
Okay.
I'll point to you. Okay, thanks, Pete. Well, it's good to see everybody again. I'm going to talk to you today about a topic that I've been working on for a number of years now. And, you know, as most of you know, I'm gone a lot, especially my students know I'm gone a lot. And I work quite a bit overseas on various things related to rivers and water and how they're managed. And what I'd like to do is share with you today at least some of the ideas, some of the things that we've been developing largely overseas that I think have some real applicability to what's going on here in the Pacific Northwest. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about environmental flows for rivers. I'll start out with a rationale of why that's important. Tell you a little bit about the theory and the progress and some of the applications that I see here, especially for Western Washington. Now, just to define environmental flows for you, depending on where you are in the world, these are also called ecological flows. Like if you're working in China, it's ecological flows. Or if you're in Australia, they call them environmental water allocations. But the definition that we use for most of our work is this one, is that we're looking at the water regimes of a river, wetland, or coastal zone that are necessary to maintain the biophysical components, ecological processes, and the health of aquatic ecosystems. And this latter part is very important, as well as the associated ecological goods and services that are provided to societies. So today, the first part of my presentation, I'll tell you a little bit about why, at least at a global scale, why we think the application of ecological flows is so important. And then I'll talk a little bit about some of the scientific advances and challenges in how we are trying to determine environmental flows for nature. So this first slide here is actually a little bit simple. I know what I'm going to show you right now, I would imagine everybody in this room is going to know already. But surprisingly, a lot of decision makers in many countries of the world don't know these things. And so oftentimes I'll start out my presentations to them with this simple thing is that, you know, fresh waters really represent the low points, low topographic points in the landscape, and they, by which, you know, they accumulate all of the changes that are imposed upon that landscape. We know with seasons, wet seasons, dry seasons, that they expand and contract rapidly. They're highly sensitive to climate variability. They have an exceptional range of physiochemical conditions, depending upon where you are in the watersheds. We know that they are, in general, important hotspots for productivity and as well as for biodiversity, and that there's strong surface-subsurface connections, as well as connections to the upper part of the watershed. Now, I'm sure for this audience, you know, those are real givens. But probably the most important thing internationally that we have going at the moment is this, is that we are at the beginning of the International Decade of Water, designated by the United Nations. It runs from the year 2005 to 2015, and probably never before have we ever had such a great opportunity to actually impact the ways by which governments use, allocate, and protect fresh waters in every UN, every country that belongs to the United Nations. And this has been just almost a godsend for us in terms of being able you know, to talk to ministers at a very high level. So why is this so important? And I would like to tell you just a little bit about this in the sense that, you know, we hear a lot these days about climate change, and it certainly is important. And the University of Washington has been a real leader in this regard in many ways. But if we look forward a number of years, a couple of decades, and we run perhaps one of the popular climate change scenarios, and we look at the different parts of the world as to whether they're going to be wetter or drier, The red is actually areas that are getting drier. The blues are getting wetter. We see quite a bit of red, and we also see some blue. But if we look at just population changes and the land changes from the increase in populations, and we drive those forward, virtually all parts of the world are becoming drier in terms of their per capita availabilities of water. And then, of course, if we combine climate change and population change, we end up with this scenario going forward, where literally most of the world is going to be drier. In fact, 80% of the change in water availability around the world is projected to be from population increases. And the consequences in fresh waters are really substantial. You know, here, just a few quick facts here, is that we already are using 50% of the available water that's out there on a global scale. We're looking at population increases of around 30% in the next few years, but only less than a 10% increase in the available waters for both human and environmental consumption. We have all sorts of trade agreements for agricultural products, and it takes a lot of water to produce food. This is just a simple example of it takes 1,000 metric tons of water to produce a metric ton of grain. And for other products, it's quite a bit more. Human appropriation of water is expected to be about 70% of that available in a few years. But at virtually every meeting I attend and every discussion I attend, there is seldom, if ever, any discussion of the needs of the environment for water. And again, that's one of the real reasons that we've been pushing this environmental flows idea is that the environment needs water too. If we look at just the needs for agriculture going forward, in another 20 years, the world will need to find the equivalent of at least 24 Nile rivers or 110 Colorado rivers just to meet the additional needs for irrigated agriculture. And I have no idea where we would find those amounts. We already have, historically, more than 250 rivers that flow between two and more countries, and this causes all sorts of political unrest, as you can imagine. And then finally, populations in water-stressed countries are expected to increase sixfold from about 500 million now to nearly 3 billion over the next few years. And already most of those countries are food importers. They cannot grow enough food to feed their existing populations. So the potential for political instability in these regions is just enormous. And of course, in the U.S., we don't hear much about the building of big dams, but on the books internationally, there are still a lot of big dams that are going to be built going forward, plus literally hundreds of thousands of smaller impoundments. And the consequences are not just that in terms of the storage of that water, and this is an old example from the Columbia River where you're looking at the natural hydrograph of the Columbia River, but probably more importantly, the change in that hydrograph from one day to the next is actually quite predictable, and that the organisms in rivers use these changes in flow actually as cues in terms of their life history and movements and so forth. This is the discharge of the Columbia River after this dam was gone in, but more importantly, this is the change in discharge from day to day. There's absolutely no biological clues left in that scatter plot. So we not only see the effects of storage and taking water away from the rivers, but also a complete change internally within the rivers in terms of the signals that they give to the ecological communities. And finally, this, I think, is one of the absolute most important figures that's been produced in years. And what it shows is based on these particular species, the populations of these species that have been followed from fresh water since 1970, that their population indices have declined by almost 60%. In just those 30 years. And we're involved in efforts now to try and extend these data beyond this year and into the future to really take the pulse of the Earth in terms of its freshwater communities. And I can tell you that this trend is not flattening off, but rather is continuing, if not in certain parts of the world, really accelerating. So with this as a backdrop of the rationale of why we need to go to a different kind of system or a different perspective for dealing with flows and rivers, we internationally have really been pushing two priority foci for doing this. And one, this first one has to do with assessment and monitoring, and I'm not going to address that today. I think in our region, we have pushed this and pushed this and pushed this. It doesn't mean we always do it very well, but this is absolutely essential in terms of going forward. The second one, though, of course, is quantifying the requirements of freshwater species as well as ecosystems for water. And it's not just how much water they need, but when it arrives, how long it stays around, what the flooding regime should be, the timing during the year, and so forth. And this, even though it sounds relatively simple, is really a daunting challenge, but I think we're finally starting to get a handle on it. Now, the reason this came about is actually rather sobering. Every 3 years, there's an international meeting at the ministerial level that occurs on water. And I guess it would have been about 5 years ago now. There was the meeting was held in Kyoto, Japan. And the ministers from most of the UN countries come. And at the end of that meeting, they are to make proclamations on how they're going to treat water, what they're going to do with it, the issues as they see them. The proclamation that came out of Kyoto, one of them, is that the world's countries can use two-thirds of the water for human development, and one-third of the water should be left for nature. That was the statement. There was absolutely no data whatsoever to support that statement. But what was even more sobering for us as ecologists, there was no data to refute it. We simply were left flat-footed. We didn't expect such a proclamation coming out of a meeting like this. And at the time, we had maybe, six, maybe seven really good groups around the world working on environmental flows, Australia, South Africa, the U.S., Sri Lanka, and so forth. And at the time, they were all working independently. They didn't agree on how to approach things. But I'll tell you, that statement absolutely galvanized the groups and the research, and they all came together and since then have really come together to try and put forth a unified voice on how we should proceed. So this is a little bit of a summary of what's happened now in the last couple of years. It's been a really very remarkable transformation in terms of the science. So this one, I think you already know, this is something I guess I tell to decision makers and ministerial staffs and so forth, is that this is why these environmental flows are so important, is because the life histories are tied to these, as well as ecosystem scale processes like nutrient cycling, water quality, and so forth. And these occur over both ecological as well as evolutionary time scales. And this seems to strike a chord with them. This is a graph that we developed after much debate. The graph took us about 2 years, surprisingly, to come up with, just to try and say to a simple way to decision makers at a very high level within governments why flow variability was important during the year. And we developed it around various principles like channel dynamics, life histories of organisms, connectivity, invasions and so forth. And I was absolutely stunned by this in the sense of going in to some of the meetings with decision makers and have them say, and these are all smart people, very smart people, but have them say this is the first time that they really understood why we had to retain flow variability in our rivers. And in Australia, this particular figure was so successful that the government established the Australian Rivers Institute and initially funded it with $20 million to get it off the ground. And I kind of wish we could do that in Puget Sound. If we didn't have problems with our ferries, we might be able to. So anyway, here is some of the recent progress. And as I said, these major research and environmental groups, especially TNC and World Wildlife Fund and IUCN, have come together, really have come together to form amazing working groups over the last couple of years. We have co-sponsored international meetings on environmental flows. The most recent one was in Brisbane, Australia, that was attended by pretty close to 1,000 people, and there's another one planned for next year. Out of that, especially out of the Brisbane meeting, came what's called the Brisbane Declaration. And Pete, maybe if you could pass some of those around. There's also copies outside if you would like to look at this. But this declaration presents a summary findings and a global action agenda that addresses the urgent needs to protect rivers on a global scale. And already, well over 100 international organizations have signed on to the Brisbane Declaration. It's really worth reading, and it would be nice going into the future if we had perhaps a Puget Sound or a Seattle Declaration that would mirror something like this. It really is having a good effect in many other countries. It really lays things out nicely. If you'd like to learn more, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature has established a website or a clearinghouse for information on environmental flows, whether you have problems, whatever it might be. And then there's a couple of new publications coming out that Angela Arthington from Australia, Michael McLean, and myself, and Krister Nilsson from Sweden are putting out a new special volume where we're trying to pull together really the state of the art of what's known about environmental flows. And then finally, as part of that, Leroy Paugh from Colorado State, along with 16 people from these various groups around the world, we have finally come together with a consensus document on how to proceed with environmental flows, or how do you do environmental flows. And this is really the guts of it. There's an environmental process here. We're very interested. We know we can't do every river in great detail, so we're looking for ways in which we can do these at regional scales or within ecoregions. There's also a social process. And to me, this is right now the weak link in all of this, that we still don't have a great social process because social decisions will need to be made about environmental flows. On the science side, I think we're doing much better. And the science side is really this. It's pretty straightforward. Is building a hydrologic foundation on stream flow time series for developed and undeveloped conditions, classifying rivers into hydrologic types, estimate the degree of hydrologic alteration based on comparisons, and developing flow ecology response curves for each of the hydrologic types. Like in a region like this, we might have, let's say, we have 10 hydrologic types. And then associate those alterations with changes in ecological condition. And this is just a schematic, but in some ways we have done these things, either for, you know, certainly for species. We haven't done them particularly well for multiple species or for ecosystem processes within the same watershed or within the same river system. But we know from groups elsewhere, like in South Africa and Australia, that these are doable, and they work very well in those situations. We might ask, what about current water management? Well, we do hear a lot about minimum in-stream flows, and I think a lot of progress in that area in the last few years. And I think, you know, progress will continue there. The in-stream flow incremental methodology is considered the best available tool at the moment for setting minimum in-stream flows and predicting available fish habitat and so forth. Now, this provides an ecologically based benchmark for regulatory base flows, but there, in my estimation, there's still a real critical need, and especially at the regional scale, that there's so much going on out there, we need to move quickly, we need to get out to much larger scales. And that critical need is really to further understand, or to develop further understanding, as well as the tools available for ecologically sustainable water management at much larger scales than we're doing now. So some considerations here should be grounded in mechanistically based science that explicitly recognizes the ecological need for hydrologic variability. Our region, I think, is the exception, but in a lot of parts of the world, decision makers still need to appreciate this. It's founded on ideas of long-term ecosystem health rather than single species management, working at a regional scale, working across all types of flow and all types of flow alterations, whether you're dealing with flow regulation by dams or looking at groups that have very different scientific capacities than we do. And then it needs to be useful regardless of the stage of water resource development and historical status of in-stream flow protection. We really are looking to develop almost a new philosophy, a new perspective going forward. So I'll end with this, and I think this is what we're trying to do here at the University of Washington. It's what we're trying to do with the groups that I work with the UN and with a couple of other international organizations, is really looking to discover how to position freshwater research so that it makes a fundamental difference in the science and applications that that really underpin sustainable water management. We're not looking to do research that's useful. What we're looking for is to do research that's used, and there's a big difference between the two. I'm going to end with this. I think this is a philosophy, a quote that's been around for a long time, but it's really one of my favorites, and it was given out, 40 years ago now. And it says, in the end, we conserve only what we love. We love only what we understand, and we understand only what we are taught. And I think at the University of Washington, we have a great obligation to be teachers here and acquire information and then to disseminate it to groups like you, which I hope you will take that in a good sense and go out and use it. So thank you very much. The question was, is the 1,000-pound crocodile in the bedroom really has to do with population changes? And you're absolutely right about that. And it's not only the population, but it's the belief systems within those populations. And that is a big part of it, in that how people perceive water, what they believe about it, what their perceptions are. And that's where we desperately need people from the social sciences, because if we can begin to work within the belief systems of the various populations, we can make great inroads into better water conservation, better water practices. That's how in Africa, like I said, I was away a lot, and I do an awful lot of work in southern Africa and in East Africa, Kenya, and Tanzania. And we've been very effective there because we're able to work within people's belief systems. Even though the populations are increasing, we can be very effective because we can very quickly get them to see our, another point of view, let's say, and they become, very, very good stewards of water. We have a much tougher time when we don't understand how people are perceiving or believing or what their religions and spiritual teachers are telling them. So you're absolutely right, and to me that's just wide open for water management. I mean, that's, you could make enormous inroads there very quickly.
I work for NOAA, and we are working with endangered fish. I'm working on a project in California now where we desperately need some numbers. I'm a lawyer, so I don't do this, but the scientists tell me we don't have the numbers. You know, all the principles that you put up there, they're very aware of that, and they're looking at ecosystems, and they're looking at hydrologic variability and ecosystem processes. Even though we're focusing on species, they know they have to look at a more broad context. But what they tell me is, but we don't have the numbers. Where are you going to get the numbers when you need them, when somebody, the water diverters, say, okay, how much water can we take out? You tell us. And our scientists say, well, gee, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, the question is, or the statement, I guess, is, you know, in Northern California and elsewhere, too, you know, people have to make the decisions, say, or the scientists say they don't have the numbers, and so where are they going to get the numbers, you know, to help make some of these decisions? And, you know, from our point of view, this is an iterative process. There's a lot of times we don't have the numbers, but how would you say, expert opinion comes into this, is that a lot of the scientists are smart people. There's a lot of people in the community that are pretty smart people, and in a way, it's starting to develop different scenarios, putting them into practice, using an adaptive management approach, and really, really making it iterative going forward. If we continue as business as usual, where, well, we don't have the numbers, so we're just going to develop this, then we're immediately down the wrong path, and we can't. It's a hard one to turn around. And so we've been going to scenario development and making assumptions, and that, you know, these things will be put into place with the idea that they will be revisited on a regular basis and refined. And again, I think a lot of us, you know, there's no way we can go out to each and every stream anymore or lake, you know, and get the number that's for specific sites. But we're all smart people, and I think we from the collective body of literature, we can make some pretty good suggestions. You know, be a little bit more proactive that way.
One more question.
Yes, you've described the issues with dams that are in stream. In Washington State, there are proposals now to put dams in areas like Crab Creek and then I think Black Rock Reservoir, where water will be pumped in and out of these dams, as I understand it. And they say that this will improve the fish habitat. Is that true?
Okay. The question was, is there, you know, there's proposals, or I guess they're already ongoing, is to develop some of these smaller dams to put water into them, pump it out of it in order to improve fish conditions. And in some cases, that may be a you know, one of the tools that has to be used. I don't know. I think it's going to depend on the particular situation and, you know, what the project goals are. But the toolbox has to be a little bit fuller than we've ever thought of in the past. And environmental flows, you know, it may be one very important tool, but this may be another one that's in a particular situation is needed, at least for a certain period of time. And, you know, rather than saying it's good or bad, I'm not sure I can't give you just one answer, but looking at the situation, I would think that, you know, somebody could say what in this particular stream, whether it's going to work or not.
Right. Thank you, Bob. Right. Thanks.